of mine. All alone I have cried, silent tears full of pride. In a world made of steel, made of
this is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York. Broadcasting locally on 90.7 FM and globally online at WGXC.org. And this is the Art of the Hudson Valley, and I'm your host, Chad Weckler. We opened with a flash dance song, What a Feeling, by Irene Cara, primarily because we've got three men of metal, made of metal, men of steel in the studio today here in Hudson. Our three guests are Bob Turan, Ron Sensor, and Chris Perry. And welcome, guys, to the studio. Let me start off with Bob. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, currently, being a man of steel, I am only that part-time. That's an avocation. I do welded metal sculpture. My day job is working at an advertising agency in Schenectady, New York, where I'm an account manager and a producer. So my creative background is starting as a filmmaker and then getting into sculpture sort of as a hobby.
Well, it's like you say, it's a vocation. So you spend a lot of time in Schenectady and also in your shop, I would imagine. Isn't your shop at your home?
Yes, it is. I have a small, I call it a studio, but it was an old tractor shed that I kept from collapsing. I did some rehab on it and put on a new roof so it would last for another 100 years or so. And that's where I started setting up my metal shop. In fact, Ron was one of the gentlemen who helped me pour a concrete floor in the place about 5 years ago now.
Well, since you mentioned Ron, Ron, why don't you introduce yourself to our listening audience?
Hi, I'm Ron Sensor. Out of Clermont, and I also have a studio on the home premise. It was a prefab building. It's about the size of a two-car garage.
Well, you're a blacksmith. For our audience, what's your definition of a blacksmith?
Basically, blacksmithing is about molding metal to different shapes than it starts out in, and either you can compress it or you can stretch it. And they're done under heat, primarily with iron or steel, sometimes stainless steel, titanium, and other materials.
So, I mean, the typical, for me, you know, blacksmithing is somebody with a fire and a hammer and an anvil and primarily horseshoes, but you don't work horseshoes, do you?
No, there are basically three kinds of blacksmiths. There's the farrier, who works with horses, and they're responsible also for horses' health from their knee down to, you know, the end of their hoof. Mm. And then there's the art blacksmith, which is what I consider myself part of, but that also includes fence and gate people and sign makers, and people who do light functional work. Mm. And then there's the industrial blacksmith, and who you typically find making parts for cars and trucks or working for the railroads.
Hmm. And since we have somebody here who works near the railroad, Chris Perry, Chris, tell us a little bit about who and where you're from.
My name is Chris Perry. I'm originally from the Bay Area in California. I've been in the Hudson Valley about 5 years. I have my studio here in Hudson in the old LB Furniture Factory. Right now I'm working on a large art project, taking industrial waste and old machinery, scrap metal, and making large kinetic sculptures out of that that are musical, and working with a lot of musicians to make compositions. I'm working on a big performance that will be at Basilica Hudson on August 10th.
Now, you're getting a lot of interesting pieces that you're working from. Isn't one piece an old X-ray machine?
Yeah, I have a kind of a control panel from an old X-ray machine. I traveled out to the Midwest and to Ohio and bought some old equipment that came out of the auto plants. I've gotten some stuff locally that came out of some dairy farms that went under, and there's some local scrap yards where I get material from as well.
Now, the project we're talking about is called Machines.
That's right.
Now, you raised a lot of money with Kickstarter. I'm kind of curious, how did you get involved in Kickstarter? And for a lot of people who have not gone through that crowdfunding process, what's it like?
Well, I had this idea for the project and put together a budget for it, which initially was about $60,000. And I needed to get going on it, and I needed some money to even fundraise. And I knew some people that had done Kickstarters to release their album, so I looked into it and created a video, and that Kickstarter campaign was successful, and it allowed me to raise some money that has allowed me to get started on the project and then continue fundraising through other methods. It's a lot of work doing a Kickstarter campaign, calling friends and begging people for money.
But I would imagine it's the process makes it a little easier. And you fortunately were successful in raising the amount that you were trying to raise.
Yeah, and one of the neat things about Kickstarter is it's a way to make people aware of your project. So, you know, you're applying to a broad base over the internet, and there were people in Australia and over Europe that supported my project. And not only was I able to get financial support from a broad range of people, but those people are now aware of the project that I'm working on.
That's pretty cool. Bob, you said you started in filmmaking. How did you get from filmmaking to metal?
Well, I guess I've always had a penchant for metal. Even years ago, I used to do small-scale sculptures, horseshoe nails, things like that. But it was about 12 years ago when I got a gift for my birthday from my wife, and it was a welding course at the Hudson Valley Community College through the BOCES program there. I always wanted to learn how to weld. And that was a strictly industrial arc welding course that gave me the basics. And after that, I just started making things, and then if I sold something, taking the money and use it to buy new equipment and try to build things that way. So little by little, I've been increasing my capabilities, the size of the shop, and getting more monumental in the scale of the stuff that I'm working on. I started with small pieces and wall hangings and then garden size things, and now I'm doing more public sculpture.
Well, all three of you have the welding capacity, and I don't. Can you explain how long it takes to become a welder or know how to weld?
Well, depending on the process, it can be fairly easy. The easiest way to weld something is with a process called MIG welding, which is gas metal arc welding. And you have a welder that has the business end of it is like a glue gun. Think of it as an electric glue gun. You put your pieces together and you pull the trigger, and magic happens, and you can actually weld things together. You can get acceptable results with that fairly quickly. There are other processes that take a lot more getting used to and developing the hand feel and the muscle memory, and the way to, I would say, to start for someone who is interested would be to take an arc welding course, because that that tends to be more difficult to figure out how to do it. And once you've done that, then the other processes become a little more easy.
How long were the classes? I mean,
well, the first one I took was one night a week, I think, for 10 weeks.
That's a commitment.
Well, it was a commitment, but it was a lot of fun. And working with guys who were going to be going out and taking certifications and working on the New York State bridges and things like that was good to see the correct way to get things done and learn what that process was.
Ron has multiple shops that he works with, not only welding, wood. You have a history in engineering, is that correct?
Yeah, I have an engineering degree in industrial design from University of Bridgeport, and I had a history before that of being in a family machinery business, so I was comfortable with big machines and tools. And going back to my days when I went to summer camp, I think when I was about 12, I took my first oxyacetylene course.
Wow.
And quickly learned which is the hot end of a rod, and kept on going from there.
That's a good age to start to learn something like that.
Yeah, it was.
You mentioned the business that you were involved with. You had a business in Soho for many years. That probably gave you an opportunity to know all facets of not products in metal and wood, and you had a lot of sculptors also come in.
Yeah, we had a lot of well-known sculptors were coming in. A lot more well-known sculptors came in. And we also supplied sculpture and art studios in the different schools and colleges in the New York area, as well as contractors and manufacturers when there still was manufacturing in New York.
Yeah, I've heard both Ron and Bob talk shop. Your knowledge of machines is quite extensive. As a funny question, what's your favorite machine or object?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's probably some gear that I don't currently have that I mean to get. As an example, a plasma cutter is something that is on my list, and I'm working towards being able to add that to my shop right now.
Maybe another birthday present.
Hopefully, it could be hopefully before then, though. One of the ways that I've been able to fund some of my work is some of my sculptures are in, they actually call them vagabond sculptures because they go around to different places. What I do is I enter them in various competitions around predominantly the East Coast. And if you get into one of these competitions, often there's an honorarium for having the sculpture be in a particular park or a city for a year. And when that happens, then I could take those funds and put it back into the building fund, if you will, for adding new stuff to the studio. What a plasma cutter would do for me would be allow me to cut complex shapes that I can't do with some of the other metal saws and the gear that I have for cutting straight lines. Mm. And it'll be possible to cut more materials than just my oxyacetylene torch will cut, which is just basically ferrous materials.
You have some good wishes. Hope they come true. I want to go to Chris now. When I go to your website, and I also, you were on Discovery Channel. There was a profile of you.
Yeah, that's correct. They came in and did a short piece on the project that I'm working on.
You've got some really interesting, I would call them sculptures, even though they're musical instruments, they're kind of the same. Do you have a favorite that you've completed or you're wanting to complete?
I'm working on a large pipe organ right now. I'm pretty excited to get that complete. Everything's interesting to me. Mm. It's exciting. I've been working on this project for almost a year now, and you get used to having a piece after it's made, and then it's always exciting to have the new one.
And you've brought some clips for us to listen to. So we're going to put a couple on, and then afterwards, and they're short clips, so you'll talk afterwards of what we just listened to. We'll probably put them up in about a minute. We're getting ready to do that.
So these clips are, I'm working on this show in August and working with musicians, Tommy Stinson, Gideon Crevichet, Chris Turco, John Rosenthal, Brian DeWan, Elvis Perkins. And so these are from our weekly jam sessions where we're kind of just playing and messing around with the instruments, trying to get inspired for compositions for the performance in August.
Who's doing the vocal on this one we're listening to?
I believe this is Gideon Crevichet and Elvis Perkins.
What are some of those sounds that we're listening to? What makes those?
So some of the sounds in the background, there's a machine that I made that's a stringed instrument that has a speaker in it directly under the strings. That creates a feedback loop. So there's pickups on the strings. And by changing the gain on the different pickups, you get different sounds out of the machine, and that's played through a large steel tank, a reverb tank, where a speaker plays into the bottom of the tank. The sound bounces around, and then a microphone picks up the sound at the top. So that's some of the ambient sound in the background. Then there's also some percussive instruments made out of large steel objects.
So you're not only doing the metal part, are you also doing the electric part?
There's these machines are operated by pneumatics and electric motors and solenoids and things like that.
How many musical instruments have you created so far?
I think right now there's probably about 12 of them. I think for the performance, I hope to have roughly 20.
Wow. Would you actually make more and then choose the cream of the crop?
Yeah, I mean, with this project, budget is my biggest limitation, and there's a lot of things that I'd like to make, but the pneumatic controls and electronics are expensive.
Let's play another track, because they're making some very interesting sounds. You know, you're not just doing a piccolo and a guitar. What's making that deep sound, like an oscillating machine?
Yeah, so that's the same machine with the strings on it and the speaker creating this feedback loop and makes a kind of pulsing sound as the strings vibrate. And then that's played back through that large reverb tank.
And all these performances and all your manufacturing is taking place in one location.
Yeah, I'm in the old LB Furniture Factory. For those of you not familiar with it, it was at one point the second largest furniture factory in the world. Mm. Employed about, I think, 300 people in Hudson. And so for a lot of people in the community, it was kind of a tragedy to see that business go out and the loss of the jobs. But I'm in there, and I think that industry has inspired this project a lot. And, you know, there's a trains down in the area and heavy trucks, and that machinery, you know, was a big inspiration in the project.
So a lot of independent sole proprietors are moving into L&B and musicians and artists.
Yeah, I think ultimately the building has a really neat potential in the community for people to come in and work on projects. There's my neighbor Sam Merritt, Full Circle Fuels, converting vehicles to run vegetable oil. Hmm. There's a couple of gyms down there. There's some people rebuilding a sailboat down there. Digifab employs, I think, about 15 people now, Peterson Geller. So there's a lot of stuff going on down there, and I think the potential for more artists and creative craftspeople to have studio space.
Isn't there also an electronics recycling plant there?
Yeah, Mr. E-Waste, and I've actually gotten some components from Mr. E-Waste to incorporate back into my sculptures.
That's pretty cool. Ron, what are some of your favorite materials that you like to work with?
Oh, boy, tough question.
Yeah. So many. So many choices.
Well, I've done everything from scrap yards and dumpster diving, finding stuff just on the curb, to going to Albany's Steel and placing an order for, you know, just over a ton of steel at a time. And then I put it into stock racks and wait for an inspiration to require them. Or I get a job to do and I try to devise a way of doing it with the stock that's on hand to keep expenses down, or to have the creative limitation of saying, okay, let's see if I could do what I need to do with what I've got on hand.
Well, you were helpful with the Germantown Library, putting shelving together, and what were some of the other things that you helped them with?
Oh, I built a bike rack for them recently, and that just got set about a week ago. Mm. And
made of metal?
Oh, yeah, it's all made out of steel tubing and had it powder coated down in Kingston. And I made some small hardware parts for railings and the doors and the handicap access.
Hmm. I don't think I've ever seen you actually do blacksmithing before, even though I've seen your anvil. What is involved in blacksmithing for you? I mean, what are some of the things that you create in that process?
Well, the training in it usually involves doing the classic or traditional blacksmith forms, and that way you learn how you can move metal around. And I think it was best to start that way, and I would like to continue with more of that traditional work, but even though that's not the kind of output I want to have, I think it's like a musician doing scales.
Hmm.
You just have to do them and do them until your hands automatically go through the motions and there's very little consciousness to the perfection that you need to have.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like almost all three of you go through a process where you have a project in mind and it's in your head, but as you're making it, things change. Bob, that seems to be one of the things that inspires you sometimes.
Yeah, I guess I get as much pleasure out of actually doing the fabrication as I do the design. And often things will change in a process. I'll have an idea, and I'll start working on it. And then the and then sometimes I say reality sets in, where gravity and physics require that I do some problem solving to try and make something work. And I enjoy that part of the process. The actual forming of the metal and watching the weld puddle as the metal melts and is something that I do enjoy. And I know there are a lot of artists out there that have their work fabricated. They'll come up with a design and give it to a shop and say, I want you to build it this way. And someone then uses their skill to do the actual construction. That doesn't work for the way that I work. I like the hands-on approach, and I learn things as I go, and often will change the design because I come up with an idea. Maybe there's a happy accident that that points me in a direction, and then I follow that. Besides working with steel, I'm also working with concrete and polished concrete in particular. I found out that a lot of the same grinding types of tools and equipment that I have for working with metal, with the proper wheels, can be used to grind and polish concrete. So I've done some. I've added some terrazzo effects and some shiny pieces of glass and other objects to some of my sculpture as part of the process of being able to incorporate that.
What's the difference between concrete and cement?
Concrete is a mixture of cement is a binder. Portland cement is the stuff that sticks it all together. Concrete is when you take either Portland cement or you can use other binders. You can make a concrete with an epoxy resin binder or with asphalt. Most of the roads that you see around here are actually asphalt concrete, where the aggregate, the stone, is held together with bituminous asphalt mix. But concrete, as used in building foundations and sidewalks and things like that, is typically Portland cement mixed with sand and gravel of various sizes to get the consistency and the end product you want.
Well, Ron, have you worked with concrete or stone in your work at all?
I've used some slate and some marble. I've worked on granite, but never done a finished piece in it. And I like stone an awful lot. Even though you can't do many of the processes that I'm familiar with, it gives another set of challenges. It's a lot of fun grinding it, cutting it, drilling holes in it. And fortunately, I have a lot of the right tools to do those things when that's what's needed.
Well, what kind of bit would you use to drill into a stone?
I've used both carbide and diamond, depending upon what has to be done.
So I guess if you're using a blade, it would be either diamond or...
Oh, it would be diamond if you're using a blade. And working with diamond blades, when you work wet, is great, as long as you can do it during the summer. Of course, you're working wet, you can get drenched. Working dry becomes very tedious, and there's a lot of dust, so that's a real limitation on working dry. Also, it's very expensive using a dry cutting blade compared to a wet cutting blade.
When you say wet cutting, you're adding water or water spray to the blade while it cuts?
Generally, it's just water.
And where does that go?
Into
a sink?
Yeah, it evaporates as you go, and it leaves the residue of the stone dust.
Well, you know, Chris, if you're working, I mean, you're working electronics, you're working metal, you're working different kinds of material, and you're working in one space. Is doing one process inhibit another?
I mean, I think that's always a challenge, is having enough space to have the tools for all the things that you want to do. And I end up often collaborating with other people, you know, if I need to do something in wood, rather than trying to do that in my shop and have sawdust in a place where there's, you know, open flame. I just, you know, work with other people and create, you know, wood or, you know, stone or glass objects by working with other people that have their own shop.
Sounds like you guys are constantly cleaning after each project. It just must, you know, create havoc if you don't. Chris, maybe we'll play another tune, and I'm wondering, once this August 10th, I believe, you'll be playing at Basilica Hudson, once you've done that, what comes afterwards? You're going to sell everything, or are you going to keep making?
What I'd like to do is find somebody to produce the show. The cost of making these large instruments is so prohibitive that I can't just continue doing it without some financial support. And also, moving them to travel the show around is expensive. It requires, you know, a semi-truck and a forklift on both ends. But I would like to travel the show a little bit, at least, you know, semi-locally. There are some venues around here like Mass Mocha, Art O' My, PS1 in New York City that do crossovers between fine art and music already.
What's the weight of your heaviest piece?
Probably about 2,500 pounds.
Oh, my goodness. So you can't exactly get a couple of helping hands to move that?
No, and they're too cumbersome because of their size.
Okay, what's making these sounds?
There's some bells made out of old welding tanks, an oscillator, an organ made out of vacuum cleaners, some percussive instruments that are steel with a pneumatic cylinder pushing in against a steel drum.
So it sounds like the three of you would take donations of different whatever's on your wish list. And Chris, what's on, if someone were to donate something to this project or any project in the future, what are some of the things that you would like to see and what you won't accept, that's just not acceptable to what you're making?
Well, unfortunately, space is a limitation for me. I would like to just take everything, and you know, eventually you find a place for things. But a lot of people have brought old, you know, broken tools or machines or things that have motors in it that they're not using anymore, and I've been able to, you know, take those apart and use different parts and pieces. Right now, for the project, I'm looking for some microphones to, you know, mic the different sculptures and run them through a PA.
Kind of like what we're talking into now.
Exactly.
Yep. Any microphones, or are there requirements?
Most things I can make work. You know, something that used a quarter inch or XLR cable.
So if someone had an old tape recorder microphone that was maybe 30 years old, you could still work with that?
Yeah, quite possibly.
You guys got any of those in your shop that you want to give Chris? Bob, what's on your table waiting for you?
Right now I'm doing some home repair, which is keeping me out of the welding studio. Once that's accomplished, I do have some ideas using some different techniques that will produce, again, this is using concrete, casting it in different ways to make that part of some of the sculptures that I do. That's going to be the next project, the next experiment. And it's going to be partially cast in place and then surface polished, and I'll use various added things to the concrete aggregate mix. What I've been doing so far, one of my last projects used some old blue glass that came from sake bottles that were saved by one of the gentlemen here in the studio with us. And in addition to that, I like the effect, and I've used glass before, but I'm going to start using some mirrors and other objects so that it adds additional depth, embed that in the concrete, and then when it's polished up and the aggregate and those pieces come up to the surface, it'll add an additional level of interest to the surface of the piece.
Well, it sounds like also the three of you, when you're creating a sculpture of some kind, you know, I always have the feeling when I look at something large that it's one piece and it has to be moved one piece only, but that's not necessarily true. I guess you could have a large piece that can be broken down into components. Bob and I were talking before the program about one of your sculptures.
What I've started doing at the right now, I'm trying to design most of my work so that it can be disassembled and moved if necessary by one or two people, either with a hand truck or I've actually built some moving arrangements where I've made a sled that a piece can be rolled onto and then dragged along, and one end of the sled can be put up into the back of the pickup truck, and then the other end picked up and slid in. So I've been working at that scale right now. The last piece that I had that had to be moved by a crane and a forklift turned out to be, it was a good idea until the forklift operator hit a bump and dropped the piece off the forklift, and it wound up coming apart. Easy enough to weld and put back together for me, but it was. I'm glad that happened during the deinstallation rather than the installation of the piece itself, because I was able to repair it when I got it back to the shop. But I don't have a forklift. I don't have a crane. At some point, when I have a space that's large enough to accommodate that, and if my work has grown to the size where that's going to be useful, that's something I could probably add. But in talking with the crane operator who had a beautiful truck and a crane, I asked him, and he said, well, you always, if you're a crane operator, you always wish you'd gotten the one that was one size bigger than the one you have.
Of course.
And the one that he had looked plenty big to me, but it's one of those things that when it comes to tools, if you're lifting thousands of pounds, you want to be able to have the excess capacity and the excess reach that you sometimes need to allow you to do more. So it seems like that's always on the wish list, is to get something a little bit bigger.
Yeah, always bigger. I'm going to remind our listeners, this is WGXC. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, and we were just talking with Bob Turan. And also in the studio, we have Ron Sensor and Chris Perry. We're getting close to the three-quarter mark of our hour program. I take this opportunity to remind our listeners, I was just looking at the WGXC website today and realizing how easy it makes it for our listeners and potential listeners to either become a member of WGXC or donate, and check out the scheduling. WGXC has a lot of wonderful programs throughout the day and the week, much varied. This is the first program I've done about metal and sculpture, so I'm very happy to have our three guests here who know way more than I do about the subject. Ron, going back to that, I was, you know, since we're in a theme of largeness, and weight and size, when you were doing that bike rack, was it all one piece?
Well, when I was finished, it was one piece. it was about 12 feet long, so it was just, it didn't weigh too much to handle, but it was a little bit awkward to move alone, but it wasn't impossible.
Well, when you have something that's 12 feet long, thankfully, I guess it's tubing, so is it hollow?
Yeah, it was hollow, except that I decided to give it some extra weight, so I actually filled it with inert material so that it would have a little more weight.
And how much did it weigh?
It started out at 87 pounds, and I think I got it up to a little over 100 when I was finished adding the weight.
Much different than Chris's almost ton musical instrument. Chris, when you're, what's the smallest piece that you've made for the Machines Project?
Well, there's some of the electronic things are small. I've created some, you know, different boxes to create tones and things like that. And the project started off with some prototypes last October. And, you know, some of them were, you know, maybe 50 or 100 pounds small percussive drums.
Now, you also have a fabrication business.
Yeah, I do some fabrication for furniture builders and artists.
What was the impetus? What got you going to make these musical sculpture pieces?
Well, I have a art background, and in California, I had a lot of people that I worked with and bounced ideas with that, you know, worked in sculpture or in drawing and print fine art and would do group shows and things like that. And since moving to Hudson, a lot of my friends who were creative weren't working in sculpture or visual arts. They were musicians. And so part of the project was being inspired by the landscape where my studio is, mm-hmm. the industrial landscape. And another large part of the project was wanting to collaborate with my friends who were musicians.
I was watching one of your videos recently, had Brian Dewan, who's kind of an inventor himself, isn't he?
Yeah, Brian's spectacular, a very creative person. I'm very fortunate to be able to work with Brian on my project. He does stuff in video, film strips, different visual art. He makes his own instruments. He works with his cousin, Leon, and they make things. One of the famous ones is the Dewanatron.
And you're also collaborating with musicians, and I wonder, for those musicians that don't have the metal background or the wood or creating fabrication, they bring a musical collaboration. How do you work with their advice?
Yeah, it's a really neat way to collaborate because there's not an issue of ego where if you're working with somebody that has a similar background to you in an artistic sense, it's hard for, you know, people to feel like they have their voice in there. And so we, you know, working with musicians and all the musicians that I'm working with have really different backgrounds. You know, people like Tommy who have a big background in rock and roll, and then Gideon who does like Georgian folk music and polyphonic music, and Elvis does, you know, more traditional folk background. They all bring something a little bit different to the table, so that's neat for them. And then as far as me working with them, you know, I don't have a music background at all, and they don't have a sculpture background at all, so it's neat for them to say, oh, we need, you know, in order to make music, we need this certain thing, and for me to say, oh, I, you know, you need to understand the limitations of fabrication, and, you know, maybe that can be done, or maybe it can't be done, or maybe I can, you know, come back and surprise them with something that they haven't seen in an instrument before.
So I would imagine there's an interesting learning curve for the musician who's working with one of your pieces.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they're very limited in their sounds, a lot of the instruments, but I think that forces a lot of creativity.
I've certainly seen Ron and Bob, their collaboration, and I think for you, Chris, and for my experience, it's important to collaborate, talk to other artists that maybe do the same thing that you do or do something different and potentially can inspire. Bob, and I'll go to, it's like the Bob and Ray show, except we have Bob and Ron. Can you talk a little bit about how the two of you collaborate and share your knowledge and what it might do to help inspire?
Well, sure. One of the things Ron is probably my first go-to guy that if I've got a question about how would I go about machining this or tooling that or coming up with an answer, and with his background in machinery and equipment, he can usually come up with a suggestion, with an idea. We've come up with processes. I needed to drill some holes through some logs in order to string them together on one of my recent sculpture pieces, and there wasn't a ready-made piece of machinery out there, so I was able to borrow a good-sized drill from Ron and then mount that to what I called a drilling sled and built a track for it so that I could make essentially a horizontal drill press to make repeatable holes through billets of wood that were 18 inches long and make it repeatable. So when I come up with a problem like that, he's the first person I can go to who might be able to offer advice and come up with a solution and maybe be an extra set of hands when it comes to actually doing it.
Ron, you like some of your, how you begin with a lot of your processes, you draw, you make a sketch. How does that work for you?
Sometimes better than others. sometimes I can sketch something out, but I can't come up with the materials to fabricate. And there are other times when I like to work direct, where I'll have a basic sketch that will give me the function or the form, and then I will try to imitate that with what I have or replicate it in some way, and then let the design move along as I'm assembling it. And I like to call that working directly, and that bypasses everything but the initial sketches that way.
Well, having having had that experience of working in a store, you sort of had, back in the old days, there were tons and tons of catalogs that you could go through to find electric parts and metal parts and screws and hinges. That world seems to be diminishing. Is that correct?
Well, it's changing. I still have some core catalogs, and then I go online, and I, you know, just devote hours and hours to pouring through online sites, and sometimes I can come up with just what I want, and other times I just change projects.
Well, Bob, were we talking an 18-inch drill bit, basically?
Yeah, that was, I had an actually it was a little bit longer than that, but it worked to make 18-inch holes. It was a ship auger. And it was able to fit into a half-inch industrial drill, handheld drill. And I built the sled to actually turn the drill into essentially a horizontal drill press, and was able to set it up outside on a picnic table to do the work that I needed there. Going back to Ron's idea of sourcing parts online, for a sculpture that I completed recently that was the one that you had seen that was up in Albany. It was kinetic and required a bearing for the top piece of it to rotate. I was actually able to, it was interesting, the size was a quarter inch interior diameter where a stainless steel rod went through, and a half inch exterior. And I was able to find it online through Amazon.com, and it wound up being one of a set of bearings for yo-yo design. Yo-yo builders evidently have supply shops where they can get things like that. And it was convenient to order it. And it came in a pack of 10, so I used the one bearing that I've got, and I've got 10 additional yo-yo bearings out there. If any of the listeners are working on yo-yos and could use some of these, I can be a local source.
Ron, a pet peeve of mine is going to a hardware store and buying a hinge with screws, and it's unfortunately, you know, the difference maybe of decades, you know, buying something like that 50 years ago or 75 years ago, those screws I can still use. I can use them over and over again. The ones I'm buying now seem to come apart before I'm even done using it. Why? What's happening with the quality of materials?
I can see what's happened, but I can't say why it had to be this way. But manufacturers are using cheaper and cheaper materials, softer materials, and it affects all of us at the other end of the
We're the users.
The consumers, the users. You know, we're just stuck with things that are are barely useful at all, if at all.
And Chris, you're using a lot of salvaged pieces. Do you find when you're using parts, some are better than others, and do you know why?
I mean, I think it comes down largely to the consumer not wanting to spend as much money. There are still quality products made domestically that you're able to get. I often source a lot of stuff from a company called McMaster Car, and they sell almost exclusively domestically made stuff, and their stuff is higher quality, but it costs more money. And there's, you know, it just requires people willing to spend an extra couple of dollars to get something that's, you know, made of a higher quality.
Well, has the quality of steel, for instance, changed over the years?
You know, there's different alloys that go into steel. So Albany Steel, my local supplier, they get a lot of domestic steel. And steel, I see a lot of their tubing comes from Canada. When you get some of the foreign steel, it can have a lot of impurities in it.
How can you tell beforehand?
From most of the suppliers, when you're buying, you know, larger pieces of steel, you can get a spec sheet on it that, you know, will tell you what's in the steel.
Is that true also, Bob? I mean, you're a tech head in a way.
Well, I found some of the materials that I look for. I used to go shopping at, you know, local hardware stores and box stores, things like that. And then I realized the differences in various steels. So I do get steel from Albany Steel. I can specify what I want. And for the last piece that I got from Albany, rather than buying a portion of a cut plate, I actually had them cut it to my dimensions on their plasma cutter. So I got a piece that was usable right away. It wound up costing me about the same. The weight of the steel was less, but the rest would have been scrap. I would have had to save it for either for another project, but I didn't have the ability to cut it cleanly myself, so I was able to have it done there, and it worked out just right. Other industrial supply stores, there's a store that's called Fastenal that sells steel parts for industrial uses, for building bridges and guardrails, things like that, and they have... not only do they have better screws and bolts, but they also have them in various degrees of hardness. If you're building a bridge, you want the bolts to be that much stronger than the kind of thing that you would get at a regular hardware store. And they stock that stuff or can order it for you. So that's become a good local place for me to get it. They've got stores in Schenectady and Albany, and it's a national company. So if they don't have it in the store, they can order it and within a day or so get it in for you.
As a regular consumer, can you get a high quality, let's say, steel rivet that goes on bridges if you wanted one? Or do you have to be a wholesaler or have a license to get something like that?
Well, just as a point of definition, you probably don't want a steel rivet. You probably would be getting an iron rivet, and that's something that I only learned recently watching a show about the Titanic, is that one of the problems with the sinking of that ship was the steel plates were held together with iron rivets. The rivets were made out of iron because to be riveted, they had to be softer and more malleable than the steel that they were holding together. And when it hit the iceberg, those rivets, the heads all popped off just like opening up a zipper. And if they had, if it had been welded or if they were bolted together with steel bolts, that might not have been the case.
So many things to know. I'm glad that you guys know it and I don't have to. We're coming up to the end of this hour. It went very quickly. I want to thank my guests here in the Hudson studio, Bob Turan and Ron Sensor and Chris Perry. Look forward to Machines coming up, Chris. It'll be happening during the Hudson Music Festival here in Hudson. And we can see Bob's work. Bob, do you have a website that people can go to see your work?
No, I don't have a website. I'd like to say that that's under construction, but it hasn't really even been started. The closest thing is I'm active in a couple of different blogs on the subject. There's a blog called Art Metal at artmetal.com, where sometimes my stuff is. No website yet.
And Chris, do you have a website?
Yeah, it's chrisperry.com. That's K-R-I-S-P-E-R-R-Y.com.
And Ron, you're just a hardworking guy.
That's about it.
Well, thank you for the That's About It. And I want to remind listeners, I will be back this time next month with a whole new group here in the Hudson studio.